Book 1. Tom. Chapter 1. 1873. The face emerged through the snow and fog like a spell. He squinted into the distance, trying to make sense of it, but the cold scattered frosty prickles across the white haze. He squeezed his eyelids together for a moment, brushed the freezing tears away, and then peered out again. Nothing. The face had gone. Tom shook his head, chasing the ridiculous illusion away, and turned back to the gnarled lips that were still smiling up at him. "You all right, love?" mused the lips. They barely had a tooth to defend. Above them, two coal black eyes sparkled with promise. "Lost in your thoughts." As she spoke, a package slithered into one of his hands. The few coins he had offered were expertly extricated from the other. He barely noticed. Once again he found himself staring out into the fog. Could it possibly have been? He faltered backwards. Several giant cargoes had come in that day, and the crowd was in an unforgiving mood. Shoulders jostled, sacks crashed against knobby spines, barrels bounded precariously across his pathway. Through the white air, the faint outlines of masts and funnels huddled like trees in a forest. Tom allowed his body to bend in tune with the force of the chaos and let his eyes scan the scene in one final attempt to find the face again, now more indulgent fantasy than genuine hope. And for one blissful moment, as he gazed into the distance, London's docks seemed to slip away from him, taking their noise and stench and fury with them. He imagined himself back, far, far back, in the house of red bricks he'd once known, with the speckled silver birch that brushed the windows. The memory was slowly dying, but he still clawed onto fragments of it as often as he could. The smooth banister, dead blue bottles on a heat-drenched windowsill, the smell of Mars cooking. The sand poured back in once again, an unrepentant tide. He blinked, glanced at the crush of faces and bodies around him, and squeezed the package in his hand. The touch of the thick, slightly oily paper allowed him a sliver of recompensing joy. The face had gone. It had never really existed. But they'd have a good supper in their bellies tonight. Tom and Ma and Sally. He squeezed the package again. And then an odd feeling suddenly managed both to jerk and slither through his guts at the same time. He knew that feeling well. It had been an appallingly common feature of his life so far. Walter used to call it all dried peas and eels, which was a fair approximation for what Tom could only describe as that nasty stomach wrench you get when something is most definitely wrong. Looking up, he noticed that those gnarled lips and coal black eyes were rapidly retreating through the crowd, as far away from him as possible. The old woman was already some distance away. Her small figure moved surprisingly nimbly through the oncoming obstacles. His blood suddenly quickened and he began to follow her, tearing the paper open as he moved. One quick glance confirmed his suspicions. Three. Just three measly pairs of blistered eyes peered back up at him from inside the wrapping. "Stop," he yelled after her, quickening his pace. "I paid for six herrings, not three. Stop that woman, stop her." A lock of her matted gray hair danced around a corner and he plunged after it. Something hard and sharp smarted against his leg. He winced, but continued to charge forwards, half hopping, half running through the clamor, whilst clutching the three pathetic fish to his chest. "She's a thief, I tell you," he shouted out, to no one in particular. "You look away for 1 second and..." And then he could say no more. For suddenly, out of nowhere, a giant wall of granite stepped into Tom's path and his face smashed directly into it. Instantly, the world turned into a swarm of grey flies and his mouth filled with iron. He swallowed hard. Pain whistled like hot steam through every crevice of his skull. Thankfully, the granite wall appeared to move back a little and, as Tom's vision cleared, he discovered that the pain had been inflicted not by a rock, but by the cast-iron chest of a beast masquerading as a man. A black-bearded face glowered down at him. It was framed by the wings of a hawk tattoo that embraced his trunk of a neck. "Why don't you look where you're going?" came an oozing voice. His mouth leaned down to align itself with Tom's face. But the pain was too extreme for him to summon up an answer. He gulped and stammered, still tasting the blood in his mouth. The huge man rumbled with something resembling laughter, and then, in the corner of his eye, Tom spotted an immense fist rising up into the air. It loomed over him, like a row of overstuffed sausages. He could already see his crushed face mirrored in their walls of gristle. He had to move, fast, but the crowd was closing in. He was also still reeling with pain. There wasn't a whisper of wind in his lungs. "Come on, head down," came a voice, suddenly in his ear. He started at the strange familiarity of its sound. Without a second to register what was happening, a hand gripped his arm from behind and scooped him away at a sharp angle. Another hand pushed his head down, and suddenly he was being forced through an impossibly small gap between the back of a cart and pile of sacks. His head bubbled and his feet swerved and skidded beneath him. But the vice-like grip on his arm forced him on, relentlessly. He registered very little of what came next, surrendering himself entirely to the guiding grip of the mythical figure behind him. Every inevitable collision into barrels, walls, horses, and even the outraged faces of the crowd seemed to be saved by no more than a needle's width. Magically, his body was thrust through impossible clearings, invisible lines of passage that he would never have found himself, and, as cries of outrage chased them like a furious wave, he could do little more than keep his head down, just like the voice in his ear had told him. Gradually, as the cries became a little fainter, air began to flood into his lungs again. He spat out the last of the blood and, to his overwhelming relief, felt warm life pumping back into his fingers and toes. They charged around a corner, where the crowd had thinned a little, and then the voice came to his ear again. "Now, run," it commanded. The hand unleashed itself from his arm and his feet firmly caressed the ground once more. Without a backwards glance, he drew his chest up into the air and charged forward, the cold gnawing at his cheeks as mud splattered up beneath his pounding feet. And his companion, his savior, charged with him, their feet clattering together across the cobbles and mud and shit and ice like one stupid, crazed horse. And when finally he glanced back, he caught the flicker of a green cloak ribboning around the feet of the man behind him. Tom felt his mouth curve into a smile. His racing legs danced through the air. In his head he heard violins, plucking churlishly at the gawping fishwives and the drunks in the alleys. He smelt the river again and flew towards it, laughing, on a current of warm joy. When at last they couldn't run anymore, the two men clutched at their knees and stomachs, gulping in the sweaty, blackened flavor of London's air. And then, finally, Tom allowed himself to look into the face of his friend, his dearest friend in all the world, his brother in everything but blood. Walter. Walter Balanchine. "Is it really you?" he stammered, his lungs burning with the effort. "I thought I saw you earlier, only for a second, through the fog. Thought I was going mad. And then, just as I was waving goodbye to my own face, you appear again, like that." Walter's thin mouth remained straight, but Tom knew that it was smiling back at him. He knew that face better than his own. "3 years, Walter," he spluttered. "How could you have stayed away so long?" "3 years, you say? I thought it was only two. How long have you been back?" "A few days. Thought I'd lie low about the docks for a bit. I knew you'd turn up eventually." And then his mouth did betray something of a smile. "Good thing I ran into you." Tom breathed in deeply, tears stung at his eyes. For a moment they were boys again, barefooted, hoping to catch an errand or pinch a morsel of anything they could lay their hands on. He squeezed his friend's bony shoulders tightly. "Welcome home, Walter." They wandered down to the edge of the river. Tom's mind burned with questions, and yet he could barely bring himself to utter a word. Not yet. Below them, mudlarks foraged in the grim, littered banks of the low tide. Boys as young as five crunched through the thin layer of ice that now laced the surface of the mud. The skin on their bare shins gleamed with a blue marble hue. "Remember when we tried that?" murmured Tom. Walter wrinkled his nose. "Waste of time and effort. I'd rather pick oakum." "I'd rather do neither," responded Walter. A group of boys paused in their efforts to peer back at the onlookers. Someone must have caught sight of Walter. Their faces were grey and pinched, sprinkled with fine dust, mere ghosts of childhood. And yet they were the ones who gawped in amazement. They murmured to each other with a greedy interest, pointing. Tom had almost forgotten how dreadful it was, that defensive outrage he always felt on behalf of Walter, coupled with a shameful understanding. He, after all, had also once stared at Walter Balanchine as a young boy. The first time he saw him, his jaw had almost unhinged itself in wonder and horror at the peculiar older child. How could Tom have possibly known then that that skull-faced scarecrow would go on to snatch him from danger, save his life even, again and again and again? The problem was that even in a place such as this, the rich tapestry of London's East End, visited and inhabited by people of every origin, a corner of the world where the notes of 100 different languages drifted past your ears in the space of a day, Walter Balanchine was still the most unusual-looking individual that most people had ever seen. For one thing, he was at least 2 heads taller than the average man, and this, coupled with a near-skeletal build, gave the observer the immediate impression of a long, thin spider. This impression was worsened by the fact that, for a man of such distinctive height, he had an impossibly small, sallow face. His eyes were also small, like 2 brown nuts, and he possessed no more in the way of lips than a lizard. His hair did little to assuage these unfortunate attributes. It was thin and wispy, and when it rained it stuck so closely to his head that it seemed as if he had no hair at all. "You're the ugliest thing I ever laid eyes on. Look at you, you've got the face of a reptile and the hair of an old man." Those had been the words of Mrs. Rafferty, one of their old mistresses. Walter must have been no more than 11 or 12 at the time, and he'd merely blinked back at her in response. He was used to such remarks. He'd been subjected to far worse as a result of his looks. But the butch, florid Mrs. Rafferty got the shock of her life the next morning when an entirely bald woman peered back at her from the mirror. The whole workhouse had shaken to the tune of her screams. Even the rats had taken shelter. "She's that scornful," Walter had said when Tom quizzed him about it at the time. "Scornful to the bone, that woman." Tom looked at Walter now, ensconced in a great cloak of emerald green. It didn't surprise him. In their world of greys and blacks and browns, Walter had always been entranced by color. Where others sought to paste themselves into their surroundings, melt into the muddy streets, Walter courted difference. He saw nothing strange in lurching about East London like a great, bony peacock. The emerald cloak was rich and luxurious. Walter had wrapped it fully around his body so that only his head showed, rather like a round stopper on a tall, green bottle. Even the most normal-looking person would probably have been gawped at in such a get-up. "Eh, you're a wizard or something," chided one of the mudlarks. Walter seemed to think about this for a moment and then nodded, slowly. A low mocking laugh rippled through the small group, but they began to back away nonetheless. "Come on, Walter. Let's get a drink inside you,"